Penguin Random House Audio presents Remedies for Sorrow, An Extraordinary Child, A Secret Kept from Pregnant Women, and A Mother's Pursuit of the Truth. This is the author, Megan Nix. To my mom, who taught me how to love. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. Naomi Shihab Nye. Prologue. I have a photograph I've looked at more than any others. It's a picture of my two oldest children on the day my second daughter was born. Zaylee, our toddler, is embracing our newborn Anna on a bed. Their lower halves are wrapped in an off-white knit blanket. Zaylee is wearing a heather gray romper, and Anna's upper body is bare. Anna is looking toward the window, as if she sees something no one else does. One errant chunk of her hair is angled upward, as though in good humor or resistance to the neutral colored background of perfection I'd prepared. You can't tell they're in a hospital except for the plastic identification bracelet clipped around Anna's tiny wrist, which bears no diagnosis, just her name and her weight. An in-house hospital photographer had taken this picture as part of a set, an invaluable gift from my parents after Anna's birth. For years, I looked at it closely, asking myself what I had missed. Was there some sign in her searching eyes or the pallor of her skin that might have indicated she was sick? Was there a clue in the way Anna was looking, as my mom put it, almost wistfully toward the sun? Now I know that there were no clues, no outward symptoms, as we tend to expect of infectious diseases. And this is the key to understanding what she has. What I sought cannot be found in those images, because the story is underneath them, deeper than her skin, millions of years old, and buried by factors physical, historical, and cultural that continue to layer themselves blanket-like over one of the most dangerous but overlooked diseases in the world. Now I also know I was asking the wrong question. I hadn't missed anything. I had felt Anna's differences from the very beginning. But because of the complex love and sorrow of motherhood, because of the silences that others expect of mothers, I doubted myself. The question I now ask when I look at that picture is much bigger than me. The question is, why is the field of medicine still dismissing my daughter's disease? I've found many answers over the course of the last 7 years, but I've also found something else. I don't remember who first told me about St. Thomas Aquinas's Remedies for Sorrow. I think I disregarded the idea initially, not being drawn to self-help methods, and honestly, I find his writing difficult to read. But when I thought about the years following Anna's birth, I was surprised to find that I'd experienced Aquinas's antidotes in my passage through grief, and identifying them comforted me retrospectively, proving I hadn't failed as much as I believed. I could see that despite my husband's and my assumptions and mistakes, we had also provided healing to ourselves and our children all along by living a deeply felt, thoroughly introspected life. And if I could now voice all the silences, both medical and personal, and reveal all the treatments, both physical and spiritual, then this story might help others. It might even prevent an entire condition. Part 1. Weeping. A hurtful thing hurts yet more if we keep it shut up, because the soul is more intent on it. Whereas, if it be allowed to escape, the soul's intention is dispersed, as it were, on outward things, so that the inward sorrow is lessened. St. Thomas Aquinas. 1. It's dawn when I first hear Anna's silence. The midwife is holding up my daughter, the cord between us not yet severed. She She's fully formed, but remarkably small, dangling in the first amber light of the sun. The tower of the hospital chapel is sounding out the tones of the 5:30 bell. My baby remains soundless, suspended. But she's alive, I can tell. She's looking at me intensely. She is black-haired and black-eyed. I know her name already. My husband isn't there. The midwife motions for my mom to cut the cord. My mom takes scissors to the bluish rope, then places my child in my outstretched arms. For a few seconds, I'm allowed to hold her to my chest, where I can feel the deep, repeating throb of a mallet hitting a gong. Then a doctor is called. Someone slips Anna from my hands. She's brought to the corner where people huddle over her. Towels jostle her form. Is she okay? I ask again and again. Then, like a pierced bubble, her scream breaks free and fills the room. She's okay, the doctor or the midwife says, but she's only 5 pounds. The space changes due to her sound. The pace quickens, the shades grind up into their rectangular sockets, and now the light is a raw, painful white. A nurse demands I eat a package of graham crackers and cheese. I've had no drugs for Anna's birth, and the intensity of it is still strobe lighting the room. I do as I'm told. Then I'm helped to a wheelchair in my nightgown, which is bright red with purple satin trim. I look a little more regal than I'd planned for an event that has destroyed me like this. The nurse brings Anna to me, swaddled. Her hat is too big, with tiny stripes and an oversized bow. My mom appears, holding out my phone, and says, "You need to call Luke." My husband is asleep on the fog-embalmed island in southeast Alaska, where he fishes for salmon from May to September. It's 3 a.m. there, but he answers. "I'm holding our baby," I tell him. "You are?" he responds, the sleep still like gravel in his voice. "Is everything okay?" "Yes," I say, "but she's small." "I'll take the first flight tonight," he replies. Anna is quiet. Her eyes on mine are shiny. The nurse rolls us out of the room and into an empty tiled hallway. "Hear that?" she says. "They're playing that song for your baby, for her birthday." The song is Brahms's Lullaby. The beauty of the violin is a blade, cleaving me to pieces. I'm so proud I can barely breathe. The recovery room faces west. When the pain recedes enough, I leave the bed. I sit in a rocking chair by the window and look alternately at the bruise-colored line of the Rocky Mountains against the sky and Anna's brand new, moon-white skin. Her head is the size of a grapefruit, still wet. Her hair is matted down in tiny dark swirls. And her eyes, in this light, are magnificently deep and huge, with tentative rays of gray reaching from her pupils into an oceanic blue. During those first newborn hours when babies can be spacey and sleepy, Anna stays awake. There's something different, even foreign, about this child, like she might contain something that isn't quite ours. Luke calls again. He's on his boat now, squeezing in one last day of fishing so we can afford for him to come home. I can picture him in his orange fishing overalls, the white sky, his silver boat, the rolling black sea, mountains in every direction, like they might be able to stop the colossal heaving of the ocean. We'd planned it this way months earlier, for Luke to be in Alaska and me to be in Denver, knowing he would miss Anna's birth. I'd had an unexpected C-section with Zaylee, my firstborn, and the recovery had nearly undone me. The feeling of swollen ropes in my abdomen, the painfulness of laughter, the inability to walk around the block for nearly 2 months. For my second, I wanted a chance at a non-surgical labor. The OB in Sitka had said no when I'd called from Colorado, still pregnant with Anna. "I could not try for a vaginal birth," he said, even though I pointed out that it posed the same risk for me statistically as any woman having her first child. It seemed I understood my risk better than the doctor. And yet, I would be the one.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?